On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When the music rolled each week for I Love Lucy in the 1950s, it was a truly national American event. Nearly 75% of the country's TV households gathered at the TV screen for Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz, a true mass market. Today, television's number one top-rated TV show, CSI Crime Scene Investigation, draws just 15% of TV households, and Americans have scattered. Wired magazine editor Chris Anderson says we're going to scatter much wider still in the internet age, down what he calls the long tail of highly personal interest and specialized products via eBay and Amazon and YouTube, into a new world of commerce and culture. Up next on Point, the end of the mass market as we've known it and the way of the long tail. Joining me now from San Francisco is Chris Anderson, editor-in-chief of Wired magazine. He first wrote about the long tail in an article for Wired in October 2004. His new book says it all, The Long Tail, Why the Future of Business is Selling Less of More. Chris Anderson, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
So here you've been in your niche. Now you're suddenly coming to the mass media. You're on the airwaves all over the place talking about a long tail. Why long tail? We understand niche markets and people finding those products online. Long tail, I know it's a big buzzword in your world, but not everywhere. What's a tail got to do with it?
Well, this is the point where I end up drawing a curve in the air on radio, which is probably the low point. The long tail refers to the long tail of the demand curve. And if you imagine a ski slope with a, you know, very high at the top left and then falling off very rapidly to the right, where you have a small number of things that sell a lot, that's the bit up at the left, and a large number of things that sell a little each, and that's the long tail at the right, that's the demand curve. And, you know, typically when you have limited shelf space or limited screens or whatever, you only offer the hits. And so we've only really seen the left side of that curve where all the hits are. But once you can offer everything, you pull back and you see that that curve goes pretty much forever to the right, and that those little niche, you know, markets and products don't sell a lot, but there are so many of them that they're adding up to a market that's rivaling the hits.
And it's fairly intuitive, but spell it out anyway, how the internet has stretched that long tail.
Infinite shelf space. When you have traditional distribution markets, you know, think of the Megaplex, or think of television channels, or even radio channels, or very explicitly shelf space in the store, there's a limited amount of space. Each half inch on the shelf has a certain rent, and you can only stock the things that use that space most efficiently. The ones that sell the most are the ones that get it into that very scarce channel. And the internet has infinite number of channels, infinite amount of shelf space, an infinite capacity for everything, and so you can throw it all out there. And what we're finding is when you throw everything out there, there's demand for niches that we never realized before.
Let's listen to just one example of the kind of niches, and I want to get you to give us just as many illustrations as you can here, Chris. But here's one example. Saturday Night Live aired a spoof about going to see the Chronicles of Narnia. Most viewers had found it online instead of watching the program. In the end, something that came up from a niche on the web helped boost viewership of the TV show itself.
Roll up to the theater, ticket buying what we're handling. You can call us Aaron Burr, from the way we're dropping Hamilton. Parked in our seats, moving trippy as the illest. With Pretzel Umstad and filmed with Bruce Willis. We answer so fast that we're scary. Everyone standing on when we scream Matthew Perry. The quiet in the theater room is gonna get tragic. We're about to get taken to a dream world of magic. It's the chronic, what calls of Narnia. It's the chronic, what calls of Narnia. We love it.
Okay, Chris Anderson, tell us this story. What happened here? How did this come to fame? How does it fit on your long tail?
Well, these are a bunch of guys who wanted to break into the comedy business and couldn't get their foot in the door. So what they did is they lived in a house, and they called themselves the Lonely Island Crew, and they decided that rather than, you know, just wait tables and wait for their moment to be discovered, they were just going to do it. They were going to make comedy videos, comedy music videos as in this case, and they were going to put it up on their website. And they... because now you can, because all of us basically can get out there through the web. They put them up there for free. They got popular. They got buzzed about, and they became an extraordinary web hit, a kind of grassroots, bottoms up hit.
These superfly white guys talking about seeing the Chronicles of Narnia in rap language, and not mainstream, but then suddenly it was.
And then, well, this is the great thing is that you know, if you're going to come up through the traditional, you know, blockbuster machine, you pretty much have to do things their way. There's a formula. You need to abide by the formula. And it's not a great way to do something radically different. On the web, you do what you want. And sometimes, you know, every now and then, it just resonates. It strikes a chord. So they were doing these funny videos, and it got popular. And, you know, lo and behold, they're discovered. Of course, they're discovered not by some talent agent. They're discovered by millions of people who loved them and then got signed to Saturday Night Live. And now that's where they work.
So there they go from the long tail, a kind of niche, and in their case, into the mass media. Give us more illustrations of the kind of product, the kind of service, the kind of cultural artifact that thrived before and what will thrive now and in the future in this long tail world, Chris.
Well, again, in the world of limited shelf space, that, you know, a small number of companies control you know, the way out there. A small number of companies control the doors to the consumer, and music labels are a great example. So the old model in music was, you know, you would try to be discovered by a talent scout, and again, get signed to the label. They would produce you, and they would get you out there and market you through top 40 radio. The new model is you upload your music to MySpace. You market by emailing MP3 blogs, and the rise of these MySpace rock stars. These are the bands that became popular not because they signed to a label. Often they turned down the label and got popular because they got authentic grassroots word of mouth. And Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah is one of the examples here. The Arctic Monkeys is another example that sort of came up from the grassroots. And it's now so easy to do it.
So you suggest that we're all going to be liberated from the tyranny of lowest common denominator culture by this long tail, at least on the music and film and literature front. Do you see that happening?
Well, you know, right now in music, this is very much the leading edge of this. The music industry has basically been digitizing for 10 years between, you know, the beginning of MP3s and then Napster and then iTunes and the iPod. We've now had a generation that shifted away from the record store with limited choice and online with now that iTunes has about 2 million tracks as opposed to a Walmart, which will have about 4,200 albums. So a generation has already shifted online. And what you're finding is about half of the market, half of the demand online represents music that's not available in Walmart, the largest retailer in our land. So that's an example that we're much more niche oriented than we thought, and that half the market was what I call the dark matter of the marketplace, the latent demand for low selling, you know, very narrow targeted products that weren't available in traditional stores. The next areas are things like books and DVDs. Netflix has about 60,000 DVDs compared to maybe 3,000 or 4,000 in a Blockbuster.
And you point out that they're selling across almost the entire range, kind of astonishing demand for things that you probably never heard of.
Well, this is the extraordinary thing, is that the more they put up there, the more they find demand. Netflix has 60,000 DVDs, and about 80% of them will rent at least once a month. 80% of them will rent at least once a day, and more than 90% of them will rent once a month. iTunes has 2 million tracks, and almost all of them have sold at least once. Now, these are things that were not available before. And the aggregate size of this market of a large number of small sellers is about a third of the business in both of those cases. In books, there's a Barnes & Noble or a Blockbuster, which has, you know, huge superstores. You think of them as having everything. They'll have about 100,000 books. Amazon, meanwhile, will sell about 3.7 million books. The libraries collectively have 32 million books. So again, you know, the largest retailers of our land, the companies that have defined our culture, because that's how we could get stuff, we now see represent a tiny sliver of the actual variety that's out there.
Way back when 75% of TV households watched I Love Lucy seems very far away. Is this the end of monolithic culture? Where does this take us? Into 1,000 little silos? What's the picture that you paint?
I think it's the end of the monopoly of the Blockbuster. We've had, you know, you and I have grown up in an era where we really did see the world through these monolithic, you know, cultural forces, the big stores, the megaplex, the TV networks and such. And that was the only choice we had. I think we're going to have hits forevermore. You know, hits are kind of a natural function of a gregarious species. But we won't only have those hits. Or more to the point, we won't only have the Blockbusters. We'll also have, you know, micro hits and mini stars, the extreme, the very top of the Afro-Caribbean jazz, top 40 chart, which is way down the tail compared to the top 40 of all music, but is of intense interest to people who are into that genre. And so I think, basically the hits are going to have to share the stage now with a million, smaller items, and we're going to be able to choose between them.
Kurt's calling from Oxford, Connecticut. Hi, Kurt, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Very well. What do you know, Kurt?
I just think that this is a fabulous progression in the way that things were supposed to go. I think this market has always existed, at least in my lifetime. I was born in 1959, bought my first record in 65, Wild Thing by the Trogs, big hit. But later in life, would go to thrift shops. Or places, I remember one called the Record Exchange, where it was used records. You could buy it, $2.99, $3.99 for an LP, instead of $8.99 at the big name brand, the big box store.
So you were always looking to break out of that mega hit mainstream path, and now everybody can break out. How do you think it changes our culture, our social interaction?
You're going to get exposed to so many more different points of view that aren't filtered through a boardroom someplace that thinks, hey, this is really going to sell. Maybe it won't. Although there's loads of stuff that ends up, it does sell.
And you say, let's do it, let's dance. You've been waiting for this for a long time.
I'm sorry?
You say, let's do it. You've been waiting for a long time for this. You're kind of ahead of the curve in searching the remainder bins.
I thought that this always was this is the way it was supposed to be.
Kurt celebrates it and says, let's go. Let's turn to Spokane, Washington, and Carrie. Hi, Carrie. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm appalled by this increasing niche market business. I think it's isolating people, fragmenting communities, removing people from the social sphere. Our local bookstores are incredibly important here, economically and socially.
Mm-hmm. So you're afraid, what, that the business goes to the web, the local bookstore closes, or that people won't even have books in common to talk about?
Yes, both. Local bookstores are suffering horribly. We have one that's very, very, very successful here in Spokane, Antes, and it's just by sheer will that the book groups support the bookstore and go there, and there's music, and it's a place to go in our town that isn't national look-alike everywhere you go.
Carrie, we hear it, and we thank you for your call as well. Chris Anderson, there's the thumbs up and thumbs down of it. Kurt, absolutely celebrating. Carrie, afraid for the sort of fabric of her local cultural life as the web takes it away, and for the conversations that come out of shared purchasing, if you will, of arts.
Yeah, well, to both those points, I think Kurt's absolutely right that what we're seeing here is the natural shape of demand, undistorted by the scarcity effect of limited shelf space and screens and all that. So I do think that this variety and this diversity has been around us all the time. We just couldn't see it before because we could only see the world through the big box, retailers and mega corporations. To the point about the downside of the lack of the loss of some shared culture. I think there are definitely trade-offs. What you're finding is that let's take the example where we were all the peak of the water cooler era, where we were all watching the same TV show the previous night. That is a form of linkage across our culture. I think it's a relatively superficial form of linkage. I mean, the fact that you and I saw CSI last night is a relatively superficial connection between us.
What do you talk about at the water cooler? Nietzsche?
Well, it turns out is that we obviously talk about things that are of local interest, mm-hmm. i.e., our city, what we did this weekend and our company. As far as cultural stuff, it's actually interesting. There's a slight a ban on talking about shows that aired the previous night because so many people have TiVo'd them that you don't want to ruin the ruin the surprise.
Right. So even the protocol is changing. And I'm being a little facetious, but you say it's superficial, and yet this sort of superficial awareness of things we've seen in common can be a kind of lubricant in society. It can give some sort of connectivity between people, even if it's not the great arts for the ages, day to day.
Well, as I say, we're always going to have hits, and so there will always be some things that we all share. The World Cup would be an example of that, outside of the U.S. at least. But her point was more specifically about the bookstores. Mm-hmm. And obviously, the two are not synonymous. You can have an independent bookstore without it having to be oriented around Harry Potter. And I think that, you know, it's a really interesting challenge. What is the role of a bookstore, a small bookstore, in a market where so much commerce is going online? And a couple points. First of all, Amazon only represents about 6% of book sales in America. So it's, that independent bookstore is competing with Barnes & Noble and Borders more than it is with, Amazon. The second is that in the case of used bookstores, which has been another case of a small independent, the long-tail market of an online marketplace where their inventory is available to everybody has been a huge boon. And basically, they've gone from kind of it being a shrinking industry where you could hardly find what you were looking for to one where they're growing by 30% a year. They're the fastest growing part of the book industry simply because they put their books, they put their inventories online. They're available on Amazon, and they basically made out of print obsolete. Now everything, even if it's not available new, it's available used, and we're seeing this incredible cultural richness that's been locked up in books that weren't still in print is now becoming available to all of us, and it's been great news for those small bookstores. For the independents who sell new books, obviously there's a challenge, and I think one of the things is to sort of do something you can't do online, which is be a community gathering place. Take advantage of your locality, take advantage of your links to your community around you, and I think the smart ones are doing that.
I have to say the long tail is pretty enticing. I mean, whether you applaud it or wonder where it takes us, I remember finding an old Delaney and Bonnie album I hadn't been able to find in years. Suddenly there it is from some Dutch company for $26, incredibly expensive, but I wanted it. I paid. Riders of the Purple Sage, sort of arcane, weird little personal tastes. Suddenly I'm celebrating them. Of course, those are from the deep past. What does this mean economically as we look forward, Chris? Do big factories still work here? Do they have to be all super customized? Does this push production toward kind of artisan level production? Does the mass still work?
You have both. You have the mass market, and the mass market retailers and manufacturers are fantastic. They have incredible economies of scale, and that's great for the top, X, 100, 1,000, whatever the number is. And then you have everything else. And the great thing about everything else is that it is artisanal production. It is global production. You can pull things from around the world. Japan's hits are our niches. And then you also have the amazing rise of the amateur. You have people who are making things without the intention of selling them, without the intention of making money. The blogosphere, all the people uploading videos to YouTube, all the people, uploading music to MySpace. Most of them are doing it because they want to be heard. They want appreciated. They have something to share, and now they can do it. The tools of production have been entirely democratized. And I think what the biggest trend of all this is that we professionals who have controlled the factory for so long are now competing with this army of amateurs who, guess what, have a lot to offer. Not all of them are talented, but so many of them are talented and weren't being tapped through the traditional means that we're seeing this explosion of new content that wouldn't have come out through, the regular channels.
An army of amateurs. It's a new world right there at the forefront. Let's take a call from Las Vegas, Nevada. Jefferson's on the line. Hi, Jefferson. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I think this, I'm a musician, and I've been marketing my music online since 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And my only concern is that it used to be this sort of utopic thing, where the artists went and then people went and found the music. But like MySpace that started for artists, and now it's just everybody and their dog has a space, and it really dilutes it. And then you have...
So are you saying you resent the army of amateurs, that these are no talents horning in on your world?
But what big business does, because that change really happened when MySpace got bought. And bigger than that, like American Idol, which is a program that I absolutely loathe, and it's just this huge marketing machine for bad music, they have gone into this area on the internet, and they made this American Idol underground thing that is basically more of their promotion disguised as this sort of long tail portal.
So now you've got big guys kind of putting on the camouflage of little guys to be popular. But let me ask you, Jefferson, as a musician, I would think the long tail, unless you're a superstar in Las Vegas, maybe you are, but it could, for a kind of getting into it musician without a mass following, this ought to be a helpful economic. Is it for you, or did you always dream of going to the big time, being the big star, so this is a come down?
Well, First, the only superstars in Las Vegas are artists who are retiring at the end of their careers. Second, this is awesome. For even with, you know, big companies coming in, it's awesome. I have fans in the Netherlands, in Japan. I would never know them otherwise. They searched with some keyword and found one of my songs and liked it. Impossible 10 years ago, impossible a decade ago for somebody to do that without some major label.
Jefferson, we want to hear your music. How do we find it?
It's at jeffersonm.com.
There you go, folks. The long tail wagging for Jefferson in Las Vegas. Thanks very much for your call. Chris, how about it? On the one hand, Jefferson's delighted. He's found by Danes and Japanese and you name it. On the other hand, he sees the movement that you're describing being infiltrated, hijacked by the big business he'd like to see it get away from.
Well, you know, the great thing is that there is no one movement. I mean, there is, let's imagine that that MySpace goes wrong and gets completely commercialized. Well, you know, this is a fickle audience. Remember Friendster?
Sure.
The audience will shift to the next thing that's more authentic and more grassroots. And, you know, you see things like, there's a music website called Pitchfork Media, which is basically a blog. Its key point is just how, you know, non-commercial and how kind of grassroots and authentic it really is. And it's really kind of cutting into the share of the traditional music magazines. So I think there's a huge inversion of power. It's gone from the top down. We look to the labels. We look to Top 40 Radio to set the tone, to all bottoms up. We look for the extremes. We look for the underground. We look for something even more obscure than what everyone else has found. And if MySpace gets too mainstream, then the audience will move on.
Chris Anderson, author of The Long Tail, please stand by. I want to welcome another voice into our conversation from New York. Steven Zaitchik is with us. He's a New York reporter for Variety Magazine, covers media and entertainment. Wrote a review of your book, Chris, for The Wall Street Journal, complimentary in many respects, but also not so sure that the old mass market is headed the way of the dinosaur. Steven Zaitchik, thanks for joining us. What do you think of The Long Tail thesis?
Well, hi. Thanks. Good to be here. I do agree with a lot of what Chris is saying. I mean, I think that he really hits it on the head, at least from where I sit, in terms of how technology is really disseminating culture and exposing elements of pop culture, in some cases even creating it in ways that it wouldn't have been able to create it before. Obviously, Chris spent some time in the book on Lonely Island, the comedy troupe that eventually made its way to Saturday Night Live.
Right.
And was able to get that hilarious spoof of the Chronicles of Narnia out via the web. And obviously, had there not been the web, had there not been not only the web, but I think executives combing it and sort of this long tail that he's talking about, had it not been in place, it wouldn't have reached us. And I think we'd be poorer for it.
But let's hear the tough stuff, Stephen. You say that the old paradigms may not be so fragile, and Chris Anderson is kind of a Dr. Pangloss.
Well, I do think that there's something to that. I think that what Chris is saying in his book kind of ignores some of the sort of equal and opposite adverse effects. I think one of the things we found with technology over the last, you know, several decades, not just a few years, with some of the changes he's talking about, is that there's a kind of Newtonian dynamic where for every way in which it enhances our cultural appreciation, it also seems to kind of take a run at it. And I think one example of that is something Chris talks a lot about, which is the tyranny of locality, to use his phrase, and how something like Netflix, for example, is able to unite five viewers of a niche documentary in Tucson with three in Austin.
In other words, in the old days, the only people, the tyranny of locality is that if people around us didn't know what we were talking about, nobody did. Now people anywhere can interact.
Exactly,
about it.
Exactly. And I think there's truth to that, but I think what that's also doing, and you have to look no further than Netflix to find an example of this, is that it's in some cases eroding and destroying local culture. Netflix has stated as its goal to destroy the local video store, and in many cases is doing that. So, I think technology is uniting audiences, and I think the long tail is real, but I also think it's having effects on other forms of culture, and I also think that we're not necessarily sure how this is going to go. I mean, for all the talk about all the different ways in which it's able to expose this, I'm not sure that it has. If you look at some of the viral video and some of these phenomena that he writes about, the main, first of all, they've not been very profitable for anyone, you know, independent artists or big corporations. They've also, in many cases, not been very good. I mean, it's a lot of people, you know, falling down and getting hit in their private parts.
Stephen, let me ask you, you write for Variety Magazine.
Yep.
Does that go to the ash can of history? Because it's a lot about the mega hits, if Chris is right.
No, I don't think it does. I mean, I think that culture, as he documents, I think pop culture has kind of expanded and convulsed before. I think, or rather, I should say, mass culture. I think there's no question that that culture is getting more fragmented, and the American Idols of the world are the anomalies. But I think, though, and the Pirates of the Caribbean, to take another example, which I wouldn't even say disproves the long tail. It just becomes one of the fewer mass hits. But I think that the varieties of the world and on all of us who cover entertainment will have to find ways to cover it, further down the chain. I'm not sure there's going to be this flowering of independent culture that's both profitable and persuasive as far down the tail as expansively as he claims there is.
Stephen Zajcik at Variety, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot, Tom. I appreciate it.
Chris Anderson, what do you say?
I think he's right in most dimensions. I'm a former physics guy, so I'm gonna quibble just with one bit of
the Newtonian
bit.
Piece here. Yeah,
I would say that he said equal and opposite. I would say unequal and opposite. I think you will have there are pros and cons. I think the pros outweigh the cons, but there definitely are downsides to a diminishment of shared culture. I think that a richer what I call sort of massively parallel tribal culture where you're able to kind of pursue your niche interests as very deeply and connect with other people who share them, are a huge positive and outweigh the losses in our more superficial shared culture. But there will always be both.
Mike's calling from St. Louis, Missouri. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. I think I figured out how to work this system. I mean,
well, let's hear it. How do you do it?
It's good for all of us. But what I do is sort of sit behind the body in the tail, where when I Google something, I never go for the first three possibilities. They're usually too generic or not on point.
We'll take that.
but I go down four or five to find the more interesting posts, or maybe the posts that are more relevant.
So you want a niche within generic. A niche. I mean, you're a super long tail guy. Then you want to be way down the tail.
Well, I like restaurants, local restaurants, when they vote, the top restaurants, I usually avoid the first three because they tend to be the default answers that people give, and they're not the best restaurants. The best ones are usually four or five. Those tend to be the more legitimate inputs of people that rather than the very top. I mean,
yeah.
You go to Walmart, you have the safety of Walmart in this generic large market, but you go downstream from there a little bit, and you get the more interesting, the stuff you really want.
Chris Anderson, here's a ready citizen of your long tail world. He's going even deeper into the spelunking here to get satisfaction.
Yeah, no, he's making an excellent point, which is that we assume that the best stuff is at the top. In fact, the stuff that sort of that reflects the broadest interest is at the top. The stuff that goes further down the tail is not for everyone, but for the people who it is for, it's really for. And you find that if you're into Greek history, the very best, most scholarly, exhaustively researched book on Greek history won't be a New York Times bestseller. It'll be somewhere down the tail. And so this notion that actually quality improves as you go down the tail, if you can find the best stuff, as Google, as the Google example gives you, is a real surprise and not the way we've looked at markets before.
And Mike is ready to ride that long tail in St. Louis. Mike, thanks for your call. Let's take a call from Saranac Lake, New York. Aggie's on the line. Hi, Aggie. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, what do you know?
I wanted to comment. I'm fortunate that I live in a community that the big box store is 50 miles away from me, which I appreciate. But I use the web often to search for interesting books or records, and then I try to go to my local store and see if they can order it for me. So I sort of do a combination of both keeping my ties with the community and getting out there and talking to people, as well as sort of using the web as a tool.
So you're having it both ways, Aggie. Do you find your local small businesses receptive to that? Are they happy to say, yes, indeed, we'll order that up for you when you found it elsewhere?
Absolutely. Both the bookstore in our community and the record store send out orders three times a week. You usually get it within 3 days because, they're ordering Tuesday, comes in Thursday, they order Thursday, comes in Saturday, et cetera, and they're always very happy to do that.
Chris Anderson, Aggie's making it work for her local merchants, but what's the long-term picture here? Does the web ultimately swamp them, or is there a kind of a symbiosis that might emerge?
Yeah, the long tail is great for the little guys. Now, most of the examples we've been talking about are online examples, but let's look a little more broadly. Let's look at food. Mm-hmm. So what's the long tail of food? Well, it's organic. It's artisanal food. It's links to local growers. And, you know, obviously, the old model was that, you know, the small grocer would compete with the Walmarts and would get driven out because they had less selection and higher prices. But if the small grocer does something Walmart can't do, which is have that link to the local community to be able to pull from the fresh produce that's been grown around them, then they offer something that Walmart can't offer, and they're actually taking advantage of the tyranny of locality. In that case, locality becomes their real selling point. And I think you're seeing, across the board, there's an opportunity for the small merchants to do something the big merchants can't. And, you know, as we've seen, it's so much easier to market yourself online to get attention for your differentiating qualities that if they play it well, they can actually see this as a big boon.
And even the actual store, the bricks and mortar, as we used to say, they don't get usurped in that endeavor by the web merchant, however small?
Well, some will and some won't. I mean, the real question is what are you doing that the web can't do? And if the answer is nothing, well, then, you know, maybe you should be in a different business. If on the other hand, what you're saying is, well, we offer immediacy or freshness or subject matter expertise or community or some sort of specialty that really differentiates ourselves, then you've got there's never been a better time.
Mm-hmm. Aggie, keep it rolling in Saranac Lake, and thanks for your call. Eric's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Eric, you're on the air.
Hey, Chris, this is Eric Brynjolfsson. It's good to hear you on the radio here in Boston. I agree with Chris with so much of what he's done, and I really think he's right on target with the long tail. But I just want to quibble a little bit with his last comment about the smaller merchants. I think that one of the paradoxes may be that some of the bigger merchants may do very well with the long tail. The value comes from product variety, and we did a paper where we estimated that consumers get about $1 billion of value just from the extra book selection at Amazon.
I see you're at MIT and paying attention to this long tail as well, Eric.
Yeah, it's an important phenomena, and Chris is right on target in terms of bringing attention to it. There are some really important underlying economic changes that are happening, technological and economic changes that are happening in the economy that I think are going to make this more and more important over the next 5 or 10 years.
But are you saying you think it kills the local merchant or the small-time shop or not?
I think a lot of them will be put at a disadvantage. I think that as Chris is saying, people who have a unique product, a niche product, will do better and better. But often merchants who aggregate those, like the Amazons, the Netflixes, even the Walmarts, may be a big part of the phenomenon. They'll be able to have a broader and deeper catalog than a lot of local stores will, and that way a lot of consumers will end up going to those kinds of locations to find that, 10,000th song on the Rhapsody playlist.
Chris, how about that? If it's a giant online like Amazon or eBay, does it really? Yes, they offer access to a very long tail, but they themselves are very large. So does it make a difference in the sort of character of the economy or the way that culture gets presented if it's a giant record label in the old days or Amazon Music today or Rhapsody?
Yeah, no, it's a very good point. First, a call out to Eric, who I want to credit. His work at MIT was some of the original work in characterizing the size of the long tail, and I owe him a huge debt of gratitude for that.
Great.
His point is about the slight irony, which is that we have a long tail of content, a long tail of consumers, and we have a relatively short head of marketplaces. You know, Amazon dominates its market. Mm-hmm. iTunes dominates its market. Netflix dominates its market. You know, are we in fact seeing that there's an instance where the long tail doesn't apply? And I think the answer there is that these are early days yet. Eric's point is that the merchants, or the sort of the marketplaces or aggregators that can have the largest selection have a huge advantage. And a couple thoughts about that. First is that information, that selection that they pull from, is available to everybody. So in fact, all the online music sites have about the same amount of inventory because they pull from the same databases. iTunes has a huge advantage of being connected to the iPod, and that very seamless, easy to use connection is what gives it its big advantage. But there are lots of other services out there, and these are very early days yet. I think that what you're going to see is that one size doesn't fit all for marketplace either. Let me give you an example. Classical music, incredible. You know, when I was a kid, classical music was a section in the record store that was behind, you know, glass walls with fantastic speakers and these really well-informed clerks, and you could spend your afternoon
Deutsche
in there.
Gramophone, let's go.
Oh, it was wonderful. Yep. Now that the classical music section is like four best of CDs at Walmart, it's just gone. And in bricks and mortar world, and except for certain, you know, very rare specialists, and online, although a lot of that music is available on places like iTunes, it's all displayed just like pop music. So pop music's all about, you know, band, album and track, and classical wants to be composer, conductor, you know, soloist, lead violin.
But
all
you've
this
lost
information.
That envelope, you're saying.
You've lost the envelope that really makes it easy to, you know, to pursue that interest and to find what you want. And I think there's an opportunity, for instance, for an iTunes for classical that wouldn't do everything. It's not one size fits all. Instead, it's perfect for classical. It's formatted perfectly. And I suspect there's a place for it in the larger music market. And we've seen this, you know, Google dominates its market. But then you think, well, what about, you know, different kinds of search, specialized search, you know, maps, images, music, video. And then you've got YouTube. And it turns out Google does not dominate
YouTube.com, the sort of video. Put your video up there, whoever you may be.
Exactly. So I think you know, the experience from search tells us that there is a market for niche specialists, for marketplaces that don't offer everything necessarily, although you can find them, you know, from the Googles of the world, but do offer what they offer in a customized way that's just right for that niche.
Eric, thank you very much for calling in. Let's go to Columbia, South Carolina, and Sinbar. Hi, Sinbar. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I wrote about 13 years ago a couple of historical fiction manuscripts, novels based in Ireland, and I went through the usual channels the big companies got to, senior editor level at Knopf and Crown, Random House, and got my, you know, rejection letters 4 or 5 months later, and of course no multiple submissions, you have to go one at a time.
Right.
And so I finally gone through a POD, a publish on demand outfit, which has, you know, all the tail connections, and of course you have your buzzwords for somebody is looking up the word Dublin, for example, Ireland. My book, The Harp That Once, will come up, you know, with that, and so I'm going to be in print in 6 weeks.
And published on demand, meaning they'll essentially print the books as people order them.
Exactly. But, you know, you have to do a lot of your own marketing, of course, but they also have, you know, all of the internet connections with Barnes & Noble and...
Sinbar, let me ask you, do you feel finally vindicated and liberated by this, or do you feel like you're settling for a trickle where you dreamed of a torrent?
Yeah, great question, but it does bring out the point that your guest was making much earlier in the show, where you have this army of amateurs and all of this material that would have been denied to, you know, the public and the niches through the conventional channels now available, and, you know, the niche is, I'm sure, going to be there. So.
Sinbar, we wish you very good luck with it, and thank you for calling. Okay. Chris, how about this issue of quality, and I guess I don't mean simply good or bad, but character. I mean, you know, Sinbar's book didn't hit the editor at Knopf. Now he's going to be publishing it on demand. It's part of your long tail. It may have a character that wasn't considered a mainstream seller. I don't know. Might we see, you know, not just difference in good or bad, but the kind of culture that gets exposed in this realm?
Absolutely. Knowing nothing about this instance, I would guess that there's nothing, you know, that the editor at the big publisher made the right decision for his marketplace, which is that they need to sell books in the 50, 100, you know, 200,000 range, and this wasn't going to sell that. He thought it wasn't going to sell in that range, and Sinbar as well, you know, wrote the book I presume he wanted to write without compromising it to reach a broader audience. And the problem was just what we call an impedance mismatch, which is that you know, a channel that's only built for blockbusters doesn't fit niche products. And so now we have print-on-demand, where you have basically glorified photocopier technology allows you to print books in batches of you know, 10, 100, 500, 1,000, something like that. And now rather than sort of it being, you know, all or nothing, a big hit or not published at all, you can have a small title that reaches just the audience that's right for it. And I think, you know, you're seeing the same thing with video. We all now have you know, video cam, digital camcorders and video mixing software, video editing software on our laptops for music. We can all, you know, we have GarageBand. We can all do music. We have blogs. We can all publish. And so in a sense, this democratization of the tools of production has been a huge driver in populating the tale with this, you know, abundance of riches that wouldn't have otherwise got out there.
Let's get one more call from Dirk in Chicago. Hi, Dirk. You're on the air.
Hello. I work in search engine optimization,
mm-hmm.
and I just wanted to make the point that, contrary to what the gentleman from MIT was saying,
yes,
about how like sites like Amazon are going to continue to dominate,
yep.
the need for very specific search topics is really going to make the web more egalitarian.
So that no big vendor online will be able to be more potent than search that can take you to a small vendor.
Exactly. Like, if you're going to search for, like, say you're a Godzilla fan, and you search for Godzilla, you're not going to turn up Amazon. You're going to turn up sites from guys who are, like, nutcases and read 50 pages of Godzilla content on their website.
Right. Dirk, our time is so short, but I'm glad you called. Chris, how about it? Does ultimately this dynamic even get around the Amazon giants, the eBays, and the rest as search becomes more supple?
I think that, you know, we've trained a generation to see the world through Google. You know, people are now recognizing that a simple sort of expression of their interest in the form of keywords or a search term, they can find the most you know, extraordinary niches. They can go to the far ends of the internet and pull things out that never would have been there before. And we've become so used to finding specific stuff, pulling the diamonds from the rough using this technique, that I think you're going to see the Google effect applying to all other forms of media as well. As people expect to find everything, they get very good at you know, steering it, and they get they're only satisfied with the stuff of the highest relevance rather than settling for whatever happens to be in plain sight.
Dirk in Chicago, thanks very much for calling. Chris Anderson, a final thought here: are you doing anything but celebrating this new realm? Are you all let's go down the long tail?
Well, you know, again, I live in both worlds. I live in the mainstream media world where you know, we and television and film and music and print now have to compete with, you know, not just other mainstream media outlets, but instead this army of amateurs. I think it's going to make us better. We're going to do our job better, and those of us who add value to the web are going to survive. But it is really challenging, and, you know, looking at the way the music industry is kind of wrestling to deal with this is kind of where we all might be in a few years. The upside is that it's a richer culture for all of us.
Richer and a many splendored thing, as the mainstream media might once have said. Chris Anderson, author of The Long Tail, Why the Future of Business is Selling Less of More. It's been fascinating. Thanks so much for being with us this hour. Really a pleasure to have you.
Thanks, Tom. Enjoyed it.
We'll go out listening to the band Clap Your Hands and Say Yeah, which self-released their first album last year. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.